The war on the Western Front settled down to trench warfare. Neither side had the science and equipment needed to solve the problem of breaking through modern entrenchments and entanglements, and both sides were now compelled to resort to scientific men, inventors, and such like unmilitary persons for counsel and help in their difficulty. At that time, the essential problem of trench warfare had already been solved. There existed in England, for instance, the model of a tank which would have given the Allies a swift and easy victory before 1916. But the professional military mind is, by necessity, an inferior and unimaginative mind. No man of high intellectual quality would willingly imprison his gifts in such a calling. Nearly all supremely great soldiers have been either inexperienced, fresh-minded young men like Alexander, Napoleon, and Hoch, politicians turned soldiers like Julius Caesar, nomads like the Hun and Mongol captains, or amateurs like Cromwell and Washington. Whereas this war, after 50 years of militarism, was a hopelessly professional war. From first to last, it was impossible to get it out of the hands of the regular generals, and neither the German nor Allied headquarters was disposed to regard an invention with toleration that would destroy their traditional methods. The tank was not only disagreeably strange to these military gentlemen, but it gave an unprofessional protection to the common soldiers within it. The Germans, however, did make some innovations. In February, the 28th, they produced a rather futile novelty, the flame projector, the user of which was in constant danger of being burnt alive. And in April, in the midst of a second great offensive upon the British, Second Battle of Ypres, April the 17th to May the 17th, they employed a cloud of poison gas. This horrible device was used against Algerian and Canadian troops. It shook them by the physical torture it inflicted and by the anguish of those who died, but it failed to break through them. For some weeks, chemists were of more importance than soldiers on the Allied front, and within 6 weeks the defensive troops were already in possession of protective methods and devices. For a year and a half, until July 1916, the Western Front remained in a state of indecisive tension. There were heavy attacks on either side that ended in bloody repulses. The French made costly but glorious thrusts at Arras, and in Champagne in 1915, the British at Loos. From Switzerland to the North Sea, there ran two continuous lines of entrenchment, sometimes at a distance of a mile or more, sometimes at a distance of a few feet, for example at Arras. And in and behind these lines of trenches, millions of men toiled, raided their enemies, and prepared for sanguinary and foredoomed offensives. In any preceding age, these stagnant masses of men would have engendered a pestilence inevitably, but here again, modern science had altered the conditions of warfare. Certain novel diseases appeared, trench feet, for instance, caused by prolonged standing in cold water, new forms of dysentery and the like, but none developed to an extent to disable either competent force. Behind this front, the whole life of the belligerent nations was being turned more and more to the task of maintaining supplies of food, munitions, and above all, men, to supply the places of those who day by day were killed or mangled. The Germans had had the luck to possess a considerable number of big siege guns intended for the frontier fortresses. These were now available for trench smashing with high explosive, a use no one had foreseen for them. The Allies, throughout the first years, were markedly inferior in their supply of big guns and ammunition, and their losses were steadily greater than the German. Mr. Asquith, the British Prime Minister, though a very fine practitioner in all the arts of Parliament, was wanting in creative ability, and it's probably due to the push and hustle of Mr. Lloyd George, who presently ousted him in December 1916, and the clamour of the British press that this inferiority of supplies was eventually rectified. There was a tremendous German onslaught upon the French throughout the first half of 1916, round and about Verdun. The Germans suffered enormous losses and were held after pushing in the French lines for some miles. The French losses were as great or greater. Ils ne passeront pas, said and sang the French infantry, and kept their word. The eastern German front was more extended and less systematically entrenched than the western. For a time, the Russian armies continued to press westward in spite of the Tannenberg disaster. They conquered nearly the whole of Galicia from the Austrians, took Lemberg on September 2, 1914, and the great fortress of Chamezel on March 22, 1915. But after the Germans had failed to break the western front of the Allies, and after an ineffective Allied offensive made without proper material, they returned to Russia, and a series of heavy blows, with a novel use of massed artillery, were struck first in the south and then at the north of the Russian front. On June 22, Chamezel was retaken, and the whole Russian line was driven back until Vilna, September 2, was in German hands. In May 1915, on the 23rd, Italy joined the Allies and declared war upon Austria. Not until a year later did she declare war on Germany. She pushed over her eastern boundary towards Gorizia, which fell in the summer of 1916, but her intervention was of little use at that time to either Russia or the two Western powers. She merely established another line of trench warfare among the high mountains of her picturesque northeastern frontier. While the main fronts of the chief combatants were in this state of exhaustive deadlock, both sides were attempting to strike round behind the front of their adversaries. The Germans made a series of Zeppelin and later of aeroplane raids upon Paris and the east of England. Ostensibly, these aimed at depots, munition works, and the like targets of military importance, but practically they bombed promiscuously at inhabited places. At first, these raiders dropped not very effective bombs, but later the size and quality of these missiles increased. Considerable numbers of people were killed and injured, and very much damage was done. The English people were roused to a pitch of extreme indignation by these outrages. Although the Germans had possessed Zeppelins for some years, no one in authority in Great Britain had thought out the proper methods of dealing with them, and it wasn't until late in 1916 that an adequate supply of anti-aircraft guns was brought into play, and that these raiders were systematically attacked by aeroplanes. Then came a series of Zeppelin disasters, and after the spring of 1917 they ceased to be used for any purpose but sea scouting, and their place as raiders was taken by large aeroplanes, the Gothas. The visits of these latter machines to London and the east of England became systematic after the summer of 1917. All through the winter of 1917-18, London, on every moonlit night, became familiar with the banging of warning maroons, the shrill whistles of the police alarm, the hasty clearance of the streets, the distant rumbling of scores and hundreds of anti-aircraft guns growing steadily to a wild uproar of thuds and crashes, the swish of flying shrapnel, and at last, if any of the raiders got through the barrage, with the dull, heavy bang of the bursting bombs. Then, presently, amidst the diminuendo of the gunfire, would come the inimitable rushing sound of the fire brigade engines and the hurry of the ambulances. War was brought home to every Londoner by these experiences. While the Germans were thus assailing the nerve of their enemy home population through the air, they were also attacking the overseas trade of the British by every means in their power. At the outset of the war they had various trade destroyers scattered over the world, and a squadron of powerful modern cruisers in the Pacific, namely the Scharnhorst, the Gneisenau, the Leipzig, the Nuremberg, and the Dresden. Some of the detached cruisers, and particularly the Emden, did a considerable amount of commerce destroying before they were hunted down, and the main squadron caught an inferior British force off the coast of Chile and sank the Good Hope and the Monmouth on November 1, 1914.